from when the first Jews really got off the boat, the eight Jews that got off the boat in Los Angeles and made it here. And the idea that LA was really built in many ways, Los Angeles, not Orthodox Judaism, Los Angeles was built in many ways by Jews that came here. It was, you know, the OK Corral back then. It was the wild, wild west. And really a lot of the bankers and the a lot of the builders were Jews at the time who had just gotten here. We developed the history all the way through. We got even as far as already the 1970s, 1979, which is ahead of where we're starting today. We talked about Los Angeles' first real major gadol, as far as, you know, the way we measure gadolim, I'm not sure, but someone who crosses off in every chart. Rav Simcha Wasserman was here. Rav Elchanan Wasserman. What? Oh, you're Rebbe. You're Rebbe. Oh, wow. By the way, there are a few people who traverse through different parts of these histories. One of them is Mr. Sanford Deutsch. Another one is Rabbi Gabe Elias. You pastor the Beth Jacob, the Chabad, the Iranians, everybody. We have you here. All right. So today we're going to go back in time a few years and talk about the history of Hasidim here in L.A. I'm going to leave Chabad out of discussion because we're going to figure out a night when we're going to talk about the history of Chabad in Los Angeles. It needs its own 5 hours, let alone its own hour. Okay. We started talking about the first Hasidic Rebbe in L.A., and that was 1871. That was a visit from the great-grandson of the Bala Tanya, Rav Shneur Zalman Liadi's grandson, Rav Chaim Tzvi Schneerson, was here 1871. He stayed on the night that they were doing the L.A. census. So he made it into the, if you look who was a local, a citizen here in L.A., he's there, even though he was here for a very short time. As he was visiting, he took a visit with the president. He came out here to Los Angeles. And an interesting small piece of trivia, if you're on a game show and they ask you, who's the first Hasidic Rebbe here in L.A.? The first Hasidic Rebbe to really plant roots here in L.A., so we had two Rebbes who were in Boyle Heights. We had the Clevelander Rebbe, and we learned already about the Dvorna dynasty that was here as well. Two Hasidic Rebbes that were here at the time in Boyle Heights, but that was in the history of the Boyle Heights era. All of these so far I've been able to load online. If you send me an email, I'll get you some of the back shirim to find out about Boyle Heights. But they didn't really build Hasidic movements. Who were their followers? They were Jews that were around in Boyle Heights. Were there Hasidim who were their followers? Yeah, Hasidim came out for Shechita. They came out for the hospitals that were here in LA, the better weather, the health. That's why they came out. But they really didn't plant roots, so to speak. There was no Hasidic movement. There's no Clevelander Hasidim out here in L.A. You won't run into the street. You won't meet at Brenko's or at 613. You're not going to meet a Nadvorna, a local Nadvorna, Los Angelino, who's been here all these years, because the Hasidus didn't stick. They moved. The families moved back out east. But there was a little bit where Rottenberg Shul, which we're going to get to in the Shart Fili Yavna piece, Rav Rottenberg Shul, he set up shop here. But as far as living at, you know, fearing a tish and acting as a Rebbe in the whole nine yards, that you didn't have that really here in Los Angeles after the Cleveland Rebbe and after the Navorna Rebbe left as well, until. We start with a tragic story. And the story I want to start with is a story that you may not have heard. Like I said, people came out here for different reasons. One of the great Hasidic Rebbes from a relative of the Mojitz dynasty was the Ablana Rebbe. The Ablana Rebbe had a fairly large size kehila, a large tish, and the Ablana Rebbe went to get a bracha from the Ger Rebbe to go move to Israel. This is the early 1930s. The Ger Rebbe says, I'm not a big fan of this, but if you want to go build something in Israel, you feel a cheshek to build. Many, by the way, of the Hasidic Rebbes wanted to get to Israel. You see, Rav Tzadok HaKohen tried really hard to get to Israel. Many of his followers didn't want him to go. They didn't want to lose him. People got in his way of getting there. Many Rebbes wanted to make their movement. Husyatin made it out to Israel. It's a descendant of the Rishoner dynasty. But the one who really made it out there was a student of, was a follower of the Ger Rebbe, a relative of the Mojitz dynasty. His name was Rav Yecheskel Taub. Taub is the famous Mojitz name. And the Ablana Rebbe. The Ablana Rebbe comes and to Israel, and the Ger Rebbe says, one thing I ask you, don't mingle with the secular. They're going to swallow you in. Don't mingle with the secular. That was the one thing he asked him not to do. The Ablana Rebbe, I have some pictures at home. We have a little manuscript of him with his frock, with his tzitzis, the whole nine yards, digging the land, working side by side, hand in hand, with secular pioneers who were in Israel at the time. And he felt a strong connection to the community that was there. He built a moshav, which stands to this day, is a non-Hasidic, but a what you call a Litvisha, Orthodox moshav. It's called Kfar Hasidim. He built up Kfar Hasidim. Unfortunately, he took many loans to be able to build the land. And as the war progressed, the ability to pay back the loans withered away. And even worse, malaria struck the moshav, killing many on the moshav. And to make matters worse, much of his family, his closest members of his family, perished and died in the Holocaust. So this is somebody who went to Israel to build the land, has interaction with the secular Israelis, has lost almost everything in his life. He goes off the grid, gone. Turns up in a journal I found, a Chicago Jewish journal, in 1939, shows up in a journal that says there's a man by Ezekiel Taub who is now working in a shipyard in San Francisco. He's moving up the ranks as he's shown some strong leadership and skill. This Ezekiel Taub is formerly known as the Rebbe of Yablon. So I'm tracing the story along, how this Rebbe gets from Kfar Hasidim, loses everything, pikes somebody's interest in Chicago, probably stopped over in Chicago. By the way, many prominent figures stopped over in Chicago to make the community work, so to speak. Famous Reb Chaim Zimmerman and many other Gedolim were in Chicago. So the Yablana Rebbe ends up in San Francisco in a shipyard. Sounds like a Kalbach story, right? To recover the Klippas in the shipyard in San Francisco. So, fine. He goes off the grid, gone for 2 years. Where does he end up? You can Google his name. He turns up in Los Angeles under a new name. The name is now George Nickel Taub. George Nickel changes his name entirely, shaves the beard, starts a new life here in Los Angeles. Fascinating story. I've been trying to recover whatever little stories I have about him. He started off doing odds and end job for the Kornwasser family while he was here at that period. People remember a little bit about him. Tell you one other story. He did really well after time. He started, advancing and moving ahead, had a massive office in Century City that a couple of people remember. One person came up to me and they said they remember their father sending me to somebody who didn't look religious, but my father told me when you go to him and drop off the check by him, kiss his hand and don't ask any questions. Imagine, Rebbe out here in L.A., Century City, George Nickel. 1945, if I have my year correct, the Sadi Ger Rebbe comes to Los Angeles. This was, if we talk about stature, the biggest Rebbe to appear in Los Angeles. The Sadi Ger Rebbe is also a dynasty, is also from the great Rishoner dynasty, which goes back to the Baal Shem Tov, the Mezer Tzur Magid. The Sadi Ger Rebbe comes to Los Angeles to Rabbi Tarshish's shul. My uncle, a proud member of Rabbi Tarshish's shul, had his bar mitzvah, right, by Tarshish's shul. People would walk there from Beverly Hills just to be able to walk to attend his shul, to be by Rabbi Tarshish, loyal followers of Rabbi Tarshish. So they're at Rabbi Tarshish. Rabbi Tarshish arranges a big tish in his shul for the Sadi Ger Rebbe. One of the rabbis in town, Rabbi Ginsburg, turns to George Nickel. He knows who George Nickel is. He says to George Nickel, why don't you come with me? Let's go see to the Sadi Ger Rebbe. For old time's sake, come out to see the Sadi Ger Rebbe. He says, okay, I'll go. He goes with him to the Tish. It's Rabbi Ginsburg, the Sadi Ger Rebbe, George Nickel Taub, the Yablana Rebbe, and another fellow that comes along with them. Rabbi Ginsburg is blown away by the tish that is run by the Sadi Ger Rebbe. The Sadi Ger Hasidim always with a lot of his slavos. Remember, L.A. hadn't seen stuff like this in a long time, if not ever. And at the tish, the person who came along with the two of them says, sorry, Rabbi Ginsburg says, this is magnificent. The person next to them says, this is nothing. I was at a tish. Before the war, I was at the tish of the Yablana Rebbe. That was a tish. George Nickel Taub looks to the side at Rabbi Ginsburg, and as the story goes, tears streaming down his face. According to my information, he spent the last 20 years of his life davening in Rabbi Rottenberg Shul, quiet in the corner, living his life as George Nickel. But his last wish was to be buried in Kfar Chassidim. You could see his matseva online. The matseva online tells you that here lies Hagon HaRav HaChassid, Rav Yecheskel Taub, HaRebi Meyablon. And the quote on the bottom talks about how much he loved humanity. It was a line telling you that he loved all Jews. Didn't make a difference, religious or not religious. He had a love for people. And it's interesting, the cycle of life that he came out, lost everything, ran away from everything, and in a sense came back. And to this day, his matseva could be found in Kfar Chassidim. If anybody has any more stories on him, I would love to hear it. How does Chassidus get going here in L.A.? Let's talk about that. Because if you come to my side of town, if you come to the Fairfax area, right, Hancock Park adjacent, as we call it, and you walk around on Oakwood and La Brea at the right time of day, suddenly you feel like you stepped into a warp zone and you're in a different world. Your mamish entered in a different world. You look around, you wonder, where did they all come from? How did these chassidim all get here? Tonight is their story. It starts with an individual who later would be known as Rav Isaacson. He was a bacher of 18 years old. He was a Eloi, a genius of geniuses. He learned at the time in Seikelheit, which was in Eastern Europe, Romanian town. The Seikelheit Rav was there, and the Rav turned to him and said, "This boy has an amazing head. This is a gifted scholar." He would marry his future wife, was the Yesoma, the orphan daughter, from the Atze Chaim. The Atze Chaim is Rav Halberstam. The Atze Chaim, Rav Halberstam, is the grandfather of the Rav Halberstam, who is currently a Hasidic Rebbe here in Los Angeles, who had the Atze Chaim synagogue. Where was it, on 3rd Street? It was up on 3rd Street, had the shul, the Atze Chaim shul, next to Cantor Walfish's shul. What, for extra 10 points, what's the name of Cantor Walfish's shul? Bet Kodesh? We have to look into it. We'll see. All right, we'll credit you the points retroactively when I drive down. All right. The Atze Chaim passed away at 46. His wife passed away 6 weeks later. They left 18 children. 18 children. Now let's just understand the scene here. The Atze Chaim is... I'll give you an analogy. Your big three, Lahavdil, are Mozart, Bach, and Beethoven, right? Those are like your big three. Lahavdil, the Atze Chaim is in that category. When you talk about great Hasidic Rebbes, he's in the larger-than-life category, those thunderous personalities that rarely come into the world. The Shinover Rebbe, another great one, the Shinover Rebbe was the Mesader Kedushin for the Atze Chaim. After the chuppah, he turned to the Atze Chaim and said, "You both should live together." They didn't know what the line meant for many years. By the Atze Chaim's Levaya, his wife said out loud, "I think I understand what the Shinover Rebbe meant." She knew that her time was coming soon, as the bracha of the Shinover was that their life was only together and never more to be apart. Rav Isaacson gets married at the age of 18. She, his wife, the Rebbitzin Isaacson, is 24. She's older. Why? Reputation was she was extremely picky. She was extremely picky. She's picky. She's still 24. You understand the world that you're in. If you're available at 24, it means she was picky. But at this point, you have to understand she is a Yesoma. She's an orphan. She doesn't have parents. And she understands now is the time to get married. The Satmar Rav turns to her and says, "There's one chisaron. There's one thing missing in the chassan you're about to marry, in the groom you're about to marry. He knows how to learn too well." Meaning, he understood that when you're marrying someone who is such a brilliant lamdan, it means you're essentially, when you're getting married, saying that I'm dedicating my life to the service of a gon. I understand that my life is going to be, whether in the rabbinate, whether as a rebbe, but something big. Something big. To marry into the Atze Chaim's family was very impressive. Everyone did it. Even though they weren't alive anymore and the children were orphans, every great Hasidic dynasty wanted to marry into this sect. The Kloisenberg, many others married from the children of the Atze Chaim. When they were starting to deport Jews out, so Rav Isaacson was in Kloisenberg. He went with the Kloisenberger Rebbe to Auschwitz on a train for 3 days. You want to hear stories about the Kloisenberg Rebbe. His biographies have come out of his time in Auschwitz. They're unbelievable stories. You also have to see, what's her name, from Flatbush, her husband ran Flatbush Yeshiva, Yaffa Eliyaf. You have to read Eliyaf's work on Hasidim and their stories. She also has on the Kloisenberg Rebbe, along with the Bluzhever Rebbe as well. Stories that will blow your mind. So he's with the Kloisenberger Rebbe for 3 days on a train to Auschwitz. Legend has it that him, Rav Isaacson, and the Kloisenberger Rebbe learned all the Maseches Beitza in those 3 days by heart in the train. How does he get to Los Angeles? When he survives the war, he goes immediately to Haifa. He goes immediately to Haifa. Rav Moshe Teitelbaum, from the Teitelbaum, the Sigit dynasty, Satmar dynasty. We don't have time to go into the whole how Satmar weaves in with the Atzei Chaim and the Sigiter. Rav Moshe Teitelbaum became the Sigiter Rav after the war. He was all that was left essentially in the family. The last Rav in Sigit, which we know, Sigit in a sense is the new Sigit, the last Rav in Sigit was Rav Isaacson. So the last Rebbe is Rav Moshe Teitelbaum, the last Rav, in a sense, the head of the Beis Din is going to be Rav Isaacson. So that's Rav Moshe Teitelbaum and Rav Isaacson. He stayed on for a little bit to be a Rav in Sigit, but saw there was nothing left. He left to Eretz Yisrael. He went to Israel. Why did he linger in Sigit at all? The family has a little discussion as to why he stayed at all after the war in Sigit. Everybody left. You left to America, you left to Israel, South America, you got out of there. Why did he stay in Sigit? In Auschwitz, an SS officer beat him for not working quick enough. He danced on his back so much, puncturing his lungs. His lungs collapsed while in Auschwitz. After the war in Kloisenberg, after the war was over, when he got back to Kloisenberg and Sigit, they thought that he had TB. That's what they thought was the problem. They didn't dawn on them that his lung had collapsed. They gave him intense medication, which was very and highly imperfect at the time, as though he was a TB patient. The medication almost killed him. From that point onward, he lived with a quarter of his lungs left in him, functioning and left in him. Those who have pictures of the of Rav Isaacson in Los Angeles, you'll often see him carrying around oxygen wherever he went. What he accomplished in Los Angeles with a quarter of his lung left, we don't accomplish in 100 strong lungs put together. Because Rav Isaacson could not rest for a moment, not for a second, after Auschwitz was over. After staying in Haifa for some time, they'd have to go to New York. He's got to go to Montefiore Hospital. While they're in Montefiore Hospital, they turn to him and say, "We can't help you here. Your breathing problems are too great. You need to go to the hospital, the City of Hope Hospital in Los Angeles." To understand how this all works, the strange and magnificent Hashgacha Pratis, that the SS officer if the SS officer doesn't step on Rav Isaacson, much of what we know today in LA doesn't exist. You understand this. And I'm not rationalizing why things happen and what reason they happen for, but you understand LA is different, much like we said last week at the Rav Simcha Wasserman shir. If Rav Simcha Wasserman never comes to LA, even if the yeshiva didn't last, Rabbi Krauss never gets to LA. If Rabbi Krauss never gets to LA, there's no Torah, there's no Young Israel Hancock Park, no Torah Senate. All of this is tied together in the fascinating way that all of our stories are woven together. He didn't know a single word of English when he gets to Los Angeles in 1955. So all he has with him is a German and English dictionary, and through that he's communicating in the hospital and with his doctors, and through that he learns the language. He learns while sitting in bed. He learns English while sitting in bed for a hospital for 3 months. Those that spoke to him know that when he spoke English, it sounded like, you ever have those old Rashi translations? The old versions, I forgot what company, but it wasn't Mitsuda, it was the one before Mitsuda. He sounded like the old Rashi translations because, the Cincino, because that was the English he was learning at the time. It's another sidebar, is nobody came to Los Angeles stam. You understand this? It's not until lately that people come to Los Angeles, why not? No one came to Los Angeles for no reason. You came for a very specific reason. When he gets here, there are people who remember the old world, the Hasidic life they left behind in Eastern Europe. the Wiesel, the Wiesel family, Slomovich, Jacobowitz, Grossman, other family people who appreciate what Hasidus was all about, and they remember the fond memories, and whether that world is still a viable option for them or not, it's irrelevant. He's their connection to the old world. They support him when he comes to Los Angeles. He opens up a shul, and he didn't, chas v'shalom, want to step on anybody else's domain. He opens it up on La Brea initially. What's on La Brea at the time? There is what we call Spiegel's shul, but at that time there was no rabbi at the shul. They still kept the name Spiegel's shul. That's another history. Maybe we'll cover it in the Yavne Shar Tefillah story. Okay, he opens up the shul there in the area because there's no other rav really in the area at the time. There was basically no minyan for the first 2 years. Basically no minyan for the first 2 years. So imagine someone who remembers a vibrant Hasidic life and then thought that he was on a trajectory to become one of the greatest Hasidic rebbes in Eastern Europe. And Hitler had other plans for all the rebbes and everybody else. And here he is in Los Angeles struggling to make a minyan. He's one of the founders of the Torah Semis school, helps build Torah Semis. He becomes the dean of the yeshiva. There were people who had started, as I said, this debate when it started, 51 or 55. I use 55 as the marker because that's when Rabbi Isaacson gets there. Rabbi Isaacson gives it its initial identity and its stamp that it is a school that is committed to unfiltered Torah. Modernity has no place in Torah Semis. Remember, they were the first ones to say that Rav Usher Zilberstein, who was the dean of Los Angeles, who built the Boyle Heights, the great shul in the Boyle Heights, in a sense had a handprint in Hillel and Yavne. Their community says we don't want his handprint on Torah Semis because he had a more modern worldview. Rav Isaacson becomes the dean here at Torah Semis. When Rav Isaacson comes, it's a perfect fit. It's a perfect fit. He makes the travel, as I said, in the Boyle Heights shir. And I said last week that Torah Semis had to open for a while in Boyle Heights. They lost their property here in the city, so for a while they had to open up in Boyle Heights. They then moved to Bnei Reuven, the congregation Bnei Reuven, Olympic in Fairfax, 1971. They then found the lot on La Brea, which again was last week's story. Rabbi Rubin ends up giving $100,000 for that lot to help with the initial building of the Torah Semis. Why? Because essentially it was the chance to build a intensive yeshiva here in Los Angeles. Original names that are on the building, and there are many great names that you know now today. The Menlo family was there almost from the inception. Later on, you have people like Emil Fish who are on the board, Mr. Moshe Weiss, who was on the board, who was a president for a while. He also worked as a Magid Shir in Rav Simcha Wasserman's yeshiva. The strategy behind that was Rav Simcha Wasserman said that I need the buy-in of the Hasidic community, or my yeshiva is not going to work. These were two very strong personalities which had different ways of viewing the world and different ways of viewing yeshiva life. It didn't last too long. They say he taught from 1 to 2 years in the yeshiva, and that ended. That was the end of it. One Matzei Yom Kippur, he goes to Torah Semis, Rav Isaacson, and he sees that nobody is going to clean the school. It's a mess after Yom Kippur. And they realized that they had not asked the custodial staff to come in and help clean. The family didn't know where Rav Isaacson went. Remember, I understand there's no cell phones at the time. Rav Isaacson, Matzei Yom Kippur to break the fast. Where is he? How come he's not coming home? They find him short of breath after the fast day of Yom Kippur, picking up all the garbage on the floor from Torah Semis so that when the kids come in the next day, the school should be clean. Much like the stories they tell of the Netziv in Volozhin, how he used to sweep the snow for the boys in the middle of the night. He used to go on the bus with the boys to Boyle Heights, even though there were many people who would have given him a ride, because he wanted to see what life was like for these boys, what these boys were up to. He passed away in 1976 at the age of 54, very young age. He gave everything he had, his last breath, to help build the Los Angeles community, to build a warm Hasidic feeling community here in Los Angeles, and the shul as we know it, Magen Avram. Magen Avram is named after Rav Isaacson's father. It's now Beis Yehuda. Magen Avram is named after his father, Rav Avram Yisachar Dov Isaacson, who was killed in Auschwitz. He was killed in Auschwitz. His mind was focused on one thing, Rav Isaacson, when he got to Los Angeles, and that was, how could I make this city better? How could I make this city better? That was what animated him every single day. When he woke up, why do you get out of bed when you can? But most of us can't get out of bed when we breathe just fine. How does a man like that get out of bed every morning and head to a minyan that shvach 7-8 people? Because he had in his mind to rebuild after the war, to rebuild a Jewish community. During much of his time, the Jews didn't live yet in Hancock Park. You understand, right before, Jews were banned from living in Hancock Park. So they hadn't made the move yet. We hadn't made the move yet. Did he write any svarim? How come he didn't write any svarim? Imagine, remember, he was the Gon, he was the Eloi at 18 years old. You won't find svarim from Rav Isaacson. The family will explain that the few minutes he had to sit down to write, he says, I don't have any strength. What does that mean, I don't have any strength? It means whatever energy he had was to building Los Angeles. Everything else to him was just, he didn't have the koach for. He didn't have the energy. It was a waste of time. To sit down and dedicate himself and put his entire mind to writing a sefer, he didn't have that left in him after the war. After the war. So you understand how different the histories would have been had he stayed in Eastern Europe and the war never happened for his family. I want to move on now to the next generation. His son-in-law, 1971, Rabbi Avraham Lo. Rabbi Lo, a name you may have heard of, a famous name in Los Angeles. This hasn't been discussed, much of his story has not been discussed publicly, certainly in this format, but I'll give you over what I can of his story because it is a fascinating one here in Los Angeles. Rabbi Lo was not supposed to move to Los Angeles. He wasn't supposed to be here. Rav Isaacson got sick a few months after the wedding. He was always sick, but seriously sick. And Rabbi Lo understood that his wife couldn't leave her father behind. So Rabbi Lo understood that he needs to help care for his in-laws. He needs to help care for his father-in-law. And he came to his Los Angeles. Right before Rav Isaacson passed away, he wanted that Rabbi Lo should take over the kehillah, should take over Magen Avram. At the same time, Rabbi Lo became the dean of Torah Semes. He worked hand in hand with Rabbi Krauss. Rabbi Krauss having very fond memories of working together with Rabbi Krauss was the principal, and Rabbi Lo was the dean at the time. The shul, the school, used to make a mixed banquet until Rabbi Lo got there. Understand? They used to have mixed seating banquet. A mixed seating banquet. Torah Semes used to have a mixed seating banquet. Rabbi Lo said, I'm fine with it, but don't expect me to show up to this banquet. That's why they built what we use today. A lot of people in LA used Moshe Gans Hall. Why did they? Huge, upstairs from Beis Yehuda, one of the best spaces to use, Moshe Gans Hall. Why was it built? Rabbi Lo understood it. He needed a venue where he could set the policy, where he could set the standard. These are little important anecdotes. Why? Some stories, save it for the art school. What do we need them for? Because they tell you about a pivotal shift in L.A. Up until now, you had Hasidic Rebbes coming to L.A. You had them walk through. You had them give drushes. They may have been rabbis. They may have helped build a shul in a school. But to set the tone that we are going to live differently than our counterparts, we are going to live with a certain piety that no one is expecting to come back anymore in this modern era, Rabbi Lo is the one to bring that to Los Angeles. That level of intensity of observance, Rabbi Lo is going to bring that back, and the standard was set. There were tikkunos that were enacted, decrees that were enacted for separate events. The Lakewood Kollel in its first few years had mixed banquets. Understand, the Hasidic community was steps ahead as far as these stringencies, chumras, as it came to Los Angeles. Rabbi Lo's goal eventually was to bring out a kollel. There was, at the time when he brings out a Hasidish kollel, a Lakewood kollel, which we're going to get to a whole separate night of the Lakewood community here. But the question is, Rabbi Lo said, this is not a Hasidish kollel. It's totally different. And by the way, you could feel the difference. Davin Mariv, by the way, 8:45 Mariv at the Hasidic kollel. Davin one night, 8:45 or 9, you get a better flavor than 8:45. Davin the 8:45 one night at the Hasidic Kollel, and then you could Davin 8:50 or 9 at the Lakewood Kollel. And it's a totally different feel. I'm not going to say how. You look at it yourself and you can tell it's almost different worlds, even though we all interact and everybody knows each other. He says, we need a Hasidic Kollel. Rabbi Lo, by the way, is trained in Litvish yeshivas. He learned at a Litvish yeshiva, Litvish Kollel, for 4 years. Initially, the Rabbi Lo's Balabatim were opposed to this. What do we need a kolel for? Why do we need a kolel? What were they saying in a sense? Rabbi Lo's interpretation of their no is because that what happened was, what happened to Hasidim after the war? Hasidim after the war didn't go to Hasidic yeshivas. The Hasidic yeshivas were obliterated. They were gone. So the Litvish yeshivas, the Lithuanian yeshivas, became filled in influx of Hasidic children. At that point, they threw away the gartel, so to speak. Doesn't mean they're losing their religion. It means they became Litvish, they became Litvak, so to speak, Lithuanian-style Talmid Chachamim. They got rid of the gartel, and they didn't see a need for a Hasidish kolel. Many of the people who were the supporters, the Balabatim, the Macher, so to speak, in Rabbi Lo and Rabbi Isaacson Shul, used to wear big shtreimels before they came to Los Angeles. If you saw pictures of them in Eastern Europe, their families had long payas, long beards, shtreimelach, all of that. I'm trying to think which direction to go. There's so many different directions we can go with this. Okay, I know which way I want to go. So he's set on building a Hasidic kolel. Rabbi Lo knows this is what the community needs. He's thinking for a moment how he's going to make this happen. At that point, Rabbi Lo decides to take a leap, takes a loan, and becomes successful with that loan in real estate. And he becomes exceptionally successful here in Los Angeles. So much so that he could turn back and say, I could build this Hasidic kolel myself. I'm going to go and I'm going to fly out the members of this Hasidic kolel. I'm going to bring them out. So he has this model. Torah Semis is going to set its standards. It's going to set its standards for how the parent body is going to keep themselves, what's the standard for frumkeit here in Los Angeles. That's the way he's going to go. Rabbi Lo says, we're going to change the way we look at mikvah here in Los Angeles. Rabbi Lo instituted 7 chumras in the Los Angeles mikvah, the one at Beis Yehuda. It's a questionable whether all 7 still stand today. There have been numerous renovations. Number one, I'll tell you about the chumras that Rabbi Lo enacted. Number one, rain normally comes on a roof, right? And what happens, by the way, how do you fill a mikvah? A mikvah is filled with rainwater. That's how you build a mikvah. You need rainwater that cannot be drawn and poured in. Direct flow of rainwater. So there's a shaila. Why? Because there's machines on the roof. There's an AC, there's other electronics there, and then it goes down to the floor. That's a shaila. What Rabbi Lo did was he built a separate part of the roof, 10,000 square feet, where there would be nothing on the roof. Absolutely nothing on the roof. Many mikvahs rely on the fact that you could put in a kneecap. A kneecap is a bend in the mikvah so that the water can flow in more easily. Rabbi Lo didn't want a bend or any kneecap in the mikvah. In a very complicated and intricate way, it was built with all pshutim, straight pipes, everything going straight into the water. He adopted the chumra of what's called boros. Boros are the initial pits. He adopted the initial chumras of the Ravid, which is very long to explain, but I'm telling you now, to do a chumra like the Ravid's chumra and boros costs you a lot of money when you're building a mikvah. Another problem is, how do you let in water from the rain to the pits? You're not allowed to bring it in through human interaction, through human power. So what we do is we have something called koach kocho, secondary power to make sure the water gets in there. People use pumps and the like. Rabbi Lo thought the pumps were too direct human involvement. So what did Rabbi Lo do? Very innovative idea. Rabbi Lo decided to put in a wooden ball. The wooden ball would clog up one of the holes. Once it clogs up one of the holes and the water, the pressure of the water has no way to go, it bounces and then shoots the other way. It builds a pressure, pressurizes, and able to go around in a different direction. The Satmar community has adopted Rabbi Lo's innovative idea of the wooden ball concept. He involves the hybrid of Mayan, Megashamim, other Chumras, tiles, very difficult. Tiles are usually unsmooth in the back, and the problem is they absorb water. And you can't dry the tiles, and you need to bring in fresh water. So what did he do? He put in mosaic tiles from glass that were impenetrable, unabsorbable, expensive, noblias, to make sure that the mikveh in Los Angeles was the most machmir mikveh. You understand? LA at the time was in a period in history where whatever kula you can get in Jewish life, we'll take it. If it looks like a rabbi walked by the restaurant, we'll eat there. It's kosher enough. That's what you're talking about. This is a rebuilding phase. This is the beginning of a renaissance. We're not yet in a renaissance. Rabbi Lowe says, you don't build a movement from bidyevet. You build a movement from lechatchila. You give people the ideal to strive for. They can't hit it, they can't hit it. But we should be setting the standard. It's a different model. It's a way of looking at building Judaism. And it had a significant impact here in Los Angeles. I want you to hear an amazing story. Rabbi Lowe's father-in-law passed away, Rav Isaacson. He passes away on a Thursday afternoon. Rabbi Lowe flies with the body, the nifter, to New York. His plan was to fly back to Los Angeles Friday morning. Satmarov. How does the Satmarov fit into this whole story? I'll just give you the backdrop. The Satmarov, Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum, the Satmarov. The Satmarov is the brother of the Atzei Chaim. Do you understand that? Rav Isaacson's father-in-law is the Atzei Chaim. The Atzei Chaim's brother is the Satmar Rebbe, Reb Teitelbaum. So he's going, in a sense, to his wife's uncle, right? And the wife's uncle, the Satmar Rebbe, says, stay with me for Shabbos. Well, you can't really say no to the uncle, to the fetter, the Satmar Rebbe. He turns to his wife, the Rebbetzin, Bracha Lo, and he says, do you mind if I stay for Shabbos by Satmar Rebbe? So she says, of course, the uncle asks you to stay, you stay. He stays there for Shabbos. Why did he want him to stay for Shabbos? Because he wanted him to have a conversation. And he said, I know you're thinking about coming back to New York. I know you didn't want to stay in Los Angeles and you only went because your father-in-law was ill. And I know you're thinking now about coming back to New York, but I want to tell you something. So long as you take care of your mother-in-law, see, if you bring your mother-in-law back, the Isaacson, if you bring Rebbetzin Isaacson back from L.A., in L.A. she's a queen. In L.A. she's the Rebbetzin of L.A. You schlep her out of L.A. and bring her to New York, it will devastate her. I give you my bracha that so long as you mechabed, you give kavod to your mother-in-law in Los Angeles, you will know only the greatest hatzlacha, you will know only the greatest success. He stayed back with his mother-in-law. He followed the advice of the Satmarov. For 18 years, he was mechabed her, he honored her, he took care of her, the family took care of her, and Rabbi Lowe knew unprecedented success for a Rav, certainly all Los Angeles, helping to build Torah Semes to numbers that it had never seen in its life, a building and a campus that it never imagined and dreamed it would have, to have a shul, Magen Avram, which was looked like you were in the heyday of Eastern Europe looking at something like a Rishner Shtiebel or the Belzer Shtiebel as you walked into the shul, Magen Avram, and the Hasidish Kolel, to bring out a Hasidish Kolel, all of that, all success, in real estate, tremendous success. The Rebbetzin passes away 18 years later. Rabbi Lowe told me he understood then and there that now he can no longer honor his mother-in-law. The bracha of the Satmarov was about to run out. And he said that was the year that everything started to fall apart for him here in Los Angeles. What a powerful story. What a powerful and fascinating way of looking at that 18-year run that Rabbi Lowe had here in Los Angeles. But let's look at, separate from the story of whatever happened, let's look at the legacy of the Hasidic Kolel. The first 20 Yungalite, the first 20 family members that Rabbi Lowe brought out were bombs. Not bomb in the negative sense. I mean, the bomb, you know, like positive bomb. They were amazing. Amazing group of all-stars. Rav Shochet, by the way, who we're going to meet in the history of Chabad in Los Angeles, used to give shir in the Hasidic Kolel. Rav Shochet used to give shir in that Hasidic Kolel. Now, where is he going to get the members of the Kolel from? So the only place he knew he could get members from was from Israel. Why Israel? New York is teeming with Hasidim. In New York, everybody has their family and they have their Rebbe. They got their family and their Rebbe. They're not leaving their family, they're not leaving their Rebbe. Nobody needs the money. They're not coming out to LA. Nobody needs the parnasa, so they're coming out to LA. The families all on the East Coast, the Hasidic families then, have money at the time after the war. Rabbi Lo understood that the situation in Israel was horrendous. He knew how bad the situation was for Hasidim in Israel, so he said, that's where I'm going to find my all-stars. He puts an ad in the Hebrew Hamodiah. After putting an ad in the Hebrew Hamodiah, 500 applications come back. He has a staff set up in Israel just to sift through all the applications of Kollel members. They pick 20 people. 20 people. He would bring 200 people in a span of 4 months. You understand? It's 20 Kollel members, but when you count all the family and everybody Rabbi Lo paid to bring out, you understand how everything fell behind when you think about those numbers. To bring out 200 people to come build a Kollel here in Los Angeles. I want to talk about a couple of those all-stars that came here in Los Angeles. One is here today, is the head of the Hasidish Kollel. His name is Rav Hennig. Rav Hennig was one of Rabbi Lo's, he was in the last wave of Rabbi Lo's Hasidish Kollel, a tremendous Talmud Chacham, a wonderful person to speak to, and understands his surroundings, understands the contemporary world. Contrary to popular perception, the rabbi of Beis Yehuda now, Magen Avram became Beis Yehuda, the rabbi of Beis Yehuda, who gives shir in the Chabad Solashul, Rabbi Tauber, who's also a Breslover, a hybrid between Satmar, Breslov, and now Chabad, Rav Tauber was not brought in Rabbi Lo's Hasidish Kollel. He was a member of the Litvisha Lakewood Kollel, which people don't realize. He came in as the only Hasidic member of the Litvisha Kollel. But there was one individual in particular that, to use our analogy of our classical music analogy, let's use the Mozart analogy. Mozart was this young, massive genius who people did not understand because he was so brilliant. The Hasidic Kollel had one of those individuals. His name was Rav Boimel. Rav Boimel, you could see wandering around LA in the middle of the night talking to himself, but talking and learning, saying over a Tosfos and a Mordechai and a Ktsos and a Nesivos. You could stop him any time of the day, any time of the night, and ask him anything you want in any area, and it was a non-issue. If you could understand him, you had a world open to you. He's left a little bit of a legacy behind here in Los Angeles, even though he left soon in, moved back to Israel. His Sfarim have stayed behind. And if you look in the right places, many homes have his Sfarim. Beautiful. What he couldn't communicate verbally, his pen was able to communicate. And really, for those who can make it through Hebrew, those who can make it through a Sefer, I recommend you find a copy. They're there in the Hasidic Kollel. They're in many people's homes. They were supported and they were paid for by those supporters of Beis Yehuda, of Magen Avram, of those families, of the more, those who had a more Hamish inclination. They paid for his Sfarim and their paperback Sfarim, white paperback Sfarim. Amazing. Really, really top of the line. Brilliance. And I don't think the world really knows that they exist. Not enough people know that these Sfarim exist, but they are a Los Angeles treasure, if we're collecting Los Angeles treasures. Rav Hennig was a student in Slobodka, a very chashuv, a Jungelite. He was part of the Kloisenberg Shas, three-year rapid Shas program. Those, if you meet anybody who goes to the Kloisenberg three-year Shas program, they're also at a different level than what we're used to. So you really, whatever happened with Rabbi Lo and Rabbi Lo's exit from the spotlight, he didn't leave behind a world of emptiness. He left behind a significant legacy here in L.A. The Beis Yehuda Shul is still a beautiful shul. Members of the Hasidic Kollel, now in any given month you can have, I just was a few weeks ago to see a tish of the Pittsburgh Rebbe. Many of these tishim, when the Rebbe come in, they're held in the Hasidic Kollel, and they need to go back to the legacy of Rabbi Lo. Let's continue. The story of Hasidim in LA has one more piece. And I'm afraid that piece, I've also never spoken about it publicly, but we are dealing with a serious, I don't know, I'm trying to keep it as an intellectual and honest conversation about the history of Los Angeles and part of the orthodoxy of Los Angeles. And in a mess that I will not go into too much detail with, which you all can do all the research on your own, you could figure out on your own everything that happened. We know about the Spinka interaction here in Los Angeles. Many devout followers of the Spinka Rebbe and the family got caught up in something that was not fully checked out, that was not fully kosher, which led to several other messes at the same time. And I mentioned that only this evening. if you talk about the pivotal moments in the history of LA and the Orthodox community, I'll tell you right now, that's in the 10 most pivotal moments in the history of Los Angeles. No matter how you feel about it, it had a severe impact and a ripple effect across the country and across the entire world. Issues of Mesira came to the forefront. A Jew telling on other people, mentioning other people publicly, bringing down other Jews, Jews involving other Jews, join me and join me, as the thing grew and spiderweb, kept growing and growing and growing to a mess of epic proportions, of something of which our community will still be reeling from many years ahead. Someone told me, I met with someone who is a lawyer out here in Los Angeles, and they told me this case woke up the DA's office in states, in New York, in other cities, in other locales, woke them up and said, we got to open up everything now and take a look at everybody's life in the religious community. So you talk about as far as impact. I mention this because 99% of everything I've been saying has been a largely positive impact in the history of Los Angeles. But this issue in particular, I'd be hiding something from you if we didn't mention, at least for a moment, it had a severe impact. And and many families are still suffering from it in many ways. So the Hasidic history, that's not the history of Hasidic individuals here in LA. It's a history that's related to Hasidism, how Spinka in the first place made connections, made associations here in LA, ties into everything else and those people who had fond memories of the dynasties in the East Coast. But that story notwithstanding, Hasidim here in LA are committed to still building and moving forward. And I want to close with the following thought. Hasidim in LA have accomplished something here that I think no other Hasidic community in the world has accomplished. If you're living in Square, New Square, in New York, I understand how you could build a Hasidic community. You've cut off everything around you. If you're in Muncie, I understand also how you can build a Hasidic community. You didn't cut off everything. You still got all the other Litvish communities, the modern community, you got everybody, but you're still in a frum environment. What the Hasidim of LA accomplished is something, and this is to the credit of the founders of Hasidism in LA. What they accomplished here in LA, I don't think is duplicated anywhere else in the world by Hasidim at large. And that is building a strong and vibrant Hasidic community with multiple shuls, with large influence, with giant families, with publishing of Svarim, with Kolel members and Chavrusas. You go there at night to the Hasidish Kolel, you see many Chavrusas set up throughout the community. In LA, they did it in the backdrop of one of the most secular cities in the world. That's the unique story of Hasidism here in LA. The unique legacy of Hasidism here in LA is that they have shown a paradigm to how to build a world that is still entrenched in tradition, that is entrenched in the old world, the world of Eastern Europe, the world of the Tish, the world that had chumras, the world that had dancing, the world that had singing, the world that had intense piety, how to do that still while in the modern world. And why that's interesting is because the last time I spoke here, we spoke about those that are struggling with that balance, and that's the Iranian community. The Iranian community is struggling to figure out how to balance and integrate their orthodoxy in the modern world that's here. I think the Hasidim in LA aren't having a tough time doing it. They're building despite. And the story that I think brings us home the most is I was one night learning in the Hasidic Kolel. And I walked outside because it was Kiddush Levana. And right next door were hundreds of people crowded around because a celebrity was doing a photo shoot right next to the Hasidic Kolel. And I look and I see 60 Hasidim shuckling doing Kiddush Levana. And I look and I see all these fans and paparazzi taking and looking at this what's it called, the celebrity taking a picture. And I'm like, that's the Los Angeles story. Right there, that the Hasidim are still saying Kiddush Levana and in much higher numbers than ever before. We'll stop there for tonight.